Hello, welcome to Giant Ear on Free 103.9, brought to you by the New York Society for Acoustic Ecology. Today's show is Inside Out NYC. We invited people to submit their sounds of interpretations of Inside the Belly of the Beast, which is New York City. And also, I conducted an interview with Sarah Bennett. She is the founder of the nonprofit group, the East River Music Project, and they bring free concerts to the amphitheater in East River Park. First, we're going to be playing a piece by Keith DeMadonka, and it's Newark Airport, coming into New York City. Following that, to psych you up a little for this amazing interview with Sarah, we're going to be playing a piece by Mike Hallenbeck, and it's called Pentecostal Preacher. Following that, we'll be beginning the interview. Here we go.
Thank you.
You're listening to Giant Ear on Free 103.9. This is Andrew Williams interviewing Sarah Bennett, founder of the East River Music Project, a nonprofit group that puts on free music concerts for the community at the Outdoor Amphitheater at East River Park, one of New York City's largest parks. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, how are you doing today?
I'm very good. I'm very happy to finally meet your dog, Buzzo. He's sitting here in between us. He's very sweet.
Yes. Unfortunately, he's very silent, but maybe if we coax him enough, he can make some of his world-famous sounds.
What sounds would those be?
Well, there's the low content rumble, which is like, eh. And then there's the forlorn, where have you gone, which is like, oh. It's very human. It's startling. Oh. It makes my neighbors very upset. They think someone in here has been wounded. Oh. I had to do something about that.
He's very sweet. So since this month's show on Giant Ear is about architecture, kind of inside the belly of the beast, and not Buzzo, why don't you tell us a little about the history of the band shell at the park and how you discovered it?
From what I understand, what I've read, the band shell was built, I think, back in the 1960s or earlier. It might have been built earlier, but it was its usage in the 1960s and 70s was the original site of Shakespeare in the Park. Where Joseph Papp originally started it. Then in the 70s and 80s, when the Parks Department pretty much went bankrupt with the rest of the city, they stopped using the band shell. An interesting thing about New York City parks in general is that the nicer parks that you and I know, Central Park, Union Square Park, are mostly underwritten by local businesses or corporations or private trusts. For instance, the Hudson River Trust controls River to River Festival. So while they probably have a lot of corporate sponsorship tied in somewhere, or they might, they also have, you know, a board of very rich people who sit and give money because they like the West Side. No one really likes the East Side, as far as I understand. There are no rich people living on the Lower East Side that are willing to give money. So while there are a lot of concerts going on the other side of the city, there really is nothing, you know, there's nobody helping out with the ones on this side. And at least in the 70s and 80s, when no one was helping out anyone in the parks, and Central Park was a very dangerous place to be, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. The band shell was mostly used for, like, hip-hop shows, where people would tap into the light posts. And most famously, it was seen in the finale of Beat Street, where the big battle takes place. You also remember, in Beat Street, the amphitheater had a back to it. It had a backstage, actually, like, changing areas. When in the bankrupt period in the, you know, New York to tell us the president fuck you era, we used to have bathroom attendants in every park. Oh. Now you'll notice that there are no bathrooms in any park. Yep. Except for Central Park, which is part of Tavern on the Green, and because homeless people, hookers, junkies would move into the bathrooms in the winter, they would light fires to stay warm. They'd burn the roofs out, so they just never rebuilt. They either tore them down or never rebuilt the ones that were destroyed by people living in them. So when the amphitheater sort of fell apart, they closed off the back of it. They sealed off those areas. When people moved into them, they probably burned them down. It wasn't until 2001, after many years of being totally neglected and really not used at all, that I think it was ABC, the television network, gave Aaron Brockovich $4 million and a week to fix it up with a bunch of New York City school children as part of a television special.
Aaron Brockovich.
This is after the movie and after 9/11. So when some television executives got together and thought, what can we do to lift the spirits of Lower Manhattan? I know. Let's give Aaron Brockovich millions of dollars and a fleet of adorable children to fix an amphitheater for a television special. Not the first thing that would have come to my mind, but I'm very grateful to ABC and Ms. Brockovich, because without that, the amphitheater would probably be still sitting there covered in graffiti with a lot of rotting wood and the smell of urine. And even now, though, the smell of urine remains. So if you don't worry, you haven't missed out on anything in that respect. And homeless people are still finding a way to live in it. It's, you know, it's a nice little lean-to in the Appalachian Mountain Trail that is East River Park. But a lot of the things that used to be there are gone. There is no backstage anymore. It's very hard also in terms of doing stuff there, really DIY, to access the light poles in terms of getting power. So what they do offer now is just basically the structure and the benches. And then the Parks Department is sort of like, we don't have any money. Good luck. So what we now provide are generators. We have to bring in porta potties. You're not allowed to do shows at night anyway, but you'd have to bring your own lights. The lights sort of automatically turn on, but not really, not in a way that anyone on stage would be able to see anything. And it's still mostly supposed to be geared for theater. The concerts there are sort of with much sort of grumbling from the community board and the Parks Department. It's funny because when you're in the audience and when you're walking on ground level, at least you can't hear the music the minute you get anywhere near the FDR. And the decibel rules are basically saying you have to be so quiet so that when you're so many feet from the amphitheater, you can have a conversation. You can't be louder than that. And you think, you know, how could this bother anyone? But those towers on the other side by Grand Street, and when you're above a certain floor, it is very loud. So now that the neighborhood actually cares, and it's not nice enough that we have the rich people there that will give us the money we need, but it's nice enough that we do have some friction with the neighborhood now in terms of loud noises. Because of the architecture of the amphitheater itself. It really just projects noise up and over the heads of everyone in the audience. Oh, no. So the best place to hear anything is actually if you live in those towers. It's funny because what makes the amphitheater so beautiful is now that you can see through it, you can see these beautiful boats going in the background. And, you know, we've been very blessed with good weather. It's always a sunny day and people are in the park, but we've had some very quiet performers and it's been pretty hard to hear them, especially because one time I think it was Dave Pajo who was playing and it was just him and a guitar and obviously it's amplified, but there was some wind in the microphones and the microphones are picking that up. And then there's some family is having a birthday at a picnic table directly next to the amphitheater. So you're hearing Dave Pajo compete with like, you know, My Humps or whatever was the song du jour last summer. It was a surreal moment. you could sort of see the look on his face of like, oh God, how do I compete with, you know, whatever, you know, My Name's Mike Jones, whatever the hell was coming out of the speakers next door. So it's a very weird place to see music, but it's as great as it is bad. It comes in the middle of this sort of bizarre, unique experience. Definitely better than anything in a club, I think, or most of the clubs in New York, where it's just sort of boring and smoky. The ghost of smoke, I guess. And people have a lot of attitude. It's hard to have attitude when there's bright sun in your face. You know, no, you can't be cool in the sunlight. I'll put it that way.
Okay. That was the first part of our interview with East River Music Project, Sarah Bennett, who's also simultaneously crocheting this amazing sweater while she revealed the entire infrastructure of New York City, and I basically giggled through the whole thing. So coming up, we're going to be playing a piece also by Mike Hallenbeck called Bike Shop, and this is a bike shop in Brooklyn. And I thought to follow that, it would make sense to play a piece I recorded at a Critical Mass event back in 2003. It was quite apocalyptic. It was this smashing of a car and sounds and music and baton twirling. I think you'll just have to listen to it. It's from video. It's taken straight from video and there are no edits except turning on and off the camera. So I just left them on for you to listen to. And following that, we'll go right into the second part of the interview with Sarah Bennett, the founder of the nonprofit East River Music Project.
Well, there are some seats that are more expensive, but most seats are the same.
Yeah. For you, I would say you would probably feel much more comfortable the more upright you were.
Upright.
We've got ones that keep it coming even.
You know those,
Did you see what they were just dropping these out there for real quick?
What?
Put these on this before. Can I help you with anything?
why do you feel that music is so important to people in New York City? I mean, I conducted interviews with the general public in New York City last year about sound memories and just different ideas on what sounds they hear right now. And, you know, when they talk about the sounds of the city, like the cars and the buses and all these loud sounds, they'd often refer back to just music. And that was the pleasant side of things. Being outdoors, either hearing birds, but mostly just music. I just wanted to know your thoughts on the importance of music in New York City.
Well, I've lived a lot in pretty rural areas in New Hampshire, and I've brought friends and forced them to visit me. And what always creeps them out, and that's their wording, is how quiet it gets. You know, especially in the dead of winter. If you're in rural New Hampshire in the summer, you're going to have bugs like crazy, and they never shut up. They're day and night. But at night in New Hampshire, there is nothing. There are no boats. There are no cars. There are no people. And I think one reason people love the sounds of the city, and specifically music, is because it makes them feel less alone in a lot of ways. People really hate that feeling of floating in space that happens when you are in the middle of nowhere. And I think also the part of the reason that we like to bring free music to people is because, you know, I grew up in the suburbs and also in these rural areas, and it's so easy in the suburbs to, you know, have your band meet in your garage after school. Or I went to a show maybe 5 or 6 years ago. This kid had a sizable shed in his backyard in New Jersey. It really was just a garden shed, but he had put on, like, you know, it was like, my friend's band came from Jersey. It was a bunch of kind of ABC Nario style bands playing in the gardening shed in this kid's backyard. His parents prepared a full vegan spread for him and his friends. You know, there weren't a lot of people there, but it was really touching that kids are still doing this. You know, every generation thinks they invent it, and it's totally not true. But that, you know, the kids are like in the middle of nowhere in New Jersey, but they're having punk rock shows with, you know, a kid singing Minor Threat covers next to a hose and a bunch of shovels. But the problem, yeah, the sprinkler running. The problem is you can't do that in New York. And it's too, you know, I share a rental space in Midtown with so many other people in the Music Building, which, if anyone's ever been in the Music Building, you know, is one of the more decrepit, disgusting buildings in Manhattan. Short of, you know, the Projects. It smells like dead rats. Every other band has a stupid name. It's the dumbest graffiti you've ever seen in your life, and every room becomes a noise competition with the room next to it. It's just, bands, practice spaces like that are just terrible. So if you want to be in a band, you have to spend a lot of money in order to practice. And there are so many people that are playing music, they're competing for only so many clubs, and the clubs, at least from the vantage point of Manhattan, are disappearing every year. There are fewer and fewer venues. They're moving farther and farther out. It's harder than it ever was to do anything DIY. My favorite DIY space, The Woodser, is actually becoming a home now. They're building bigger rooms, so they're probably not going to be doing shows anymore. Even in Williamsburg, it's harder and harder to do shows without getting shut down. So we thought we wanted to provide a space where bands could play, where it was open to everybody. And, you know, we obviously were so broke, we really only pay expenses. But it's exposing bands that would normally only play these house shows or, you know, the off night at the equivalent of whatever Brownies is now, which, of course, no longer exists, would get exposed to the New York community as a whole. And, you know, there's the capacity of that theater. They keep cutting it down every year because they don't want us to fill it to capacity. It used to be 1,400, now it's 1,100. It's not like they got rid of any benches. They're just deciding that, and it's not like it's a fire hazard. It's outdoors. They're just deciding to reduce it. But these bands would never get to play venues like that in the city because they're competing with too many other bands, or because those venues don't really exist anymore in an accessible way. Or it's now the Nokia Rock Theater where, you know, Coldplay decides to go when they want to impress Us Weekly. I have no idea. Long story short, I think that people enjoy music in the city because it makes them feel, in the most cliche, not see any way to say, more alive, or at least like they're surrounded by living beings, which I don't know. I read that somewhere. People hate being alone. And we like to provide that music to, you know, we're all, everything that I do is really all about community, or that's one of my big interests. And one of the reasons I didn't say this earlier, found out about the amphitheater is because I started a hockey league that plays right down there. We've moved all around East River Park below Delancey. We were first right next to the bridge, And then they started renovating parts of the park. And like I said earlier, I think those renovations are more privately funded than funded by the city. So we had a really amazing hockey court that some soccer federation paid to have turfed. So we kept getting pushed down lower and lower. When we started there, it was basically just stretches of concrete that were, you know, surrounded by fence. They weren't used for anything, maybe basketball, but never on weekends for some bizarre reason. Maybe after school kids were using them. I have no idea. But they're more convenient courts up on Rivington's, whatever. So we got pushed further and further down until we were at Corlears Hook Park, made famous in a little book called Moby Dick. That's where the hookers used to be. And we were not on the riverside anymore. We were on the other side of FDR, surrounded by the Vladeck housing projects. And there's a pedestrian bridge right there at Cherry Street. And that's when I first noticed this amphitheater. I'd been there every Sunday for, at that point, 4 or 5 years. 4 years. And never seen any music there. Never seen any plays there. I mean, you'd be able to hear it if it from where we were in the courts. Because I've heard it from the courts at this point. But only one time did I see a concert there. It was after I'd gotten the idea to start shows. And it was like a Christian reggae show. I've heard there were children's plays on Saturdays, but I would never be there on Saturdays. So I had that weekend, one weekend that summer, just for the Saturday, I had to be back by Sunday for hockey. I went to visit a friend of mine in Northampton, Massachusetts, to see Fugazi at the Holyoke Center. And in all my years growing up in Boston, Fugazi would never play in Massachusetts because there were no all-ages venues big enough to take them. So we would always drive to Providence, this place called Lupo's. So seeing that show at the Holyoke Center and seeing Fugazi was... I've seen Fugazi maybe 15 or 20 times. They are one of my favorite bands. On the bus ride home, it just struck me, like, why don't we have something like Flywheel in New York? I mean, the obvious reason is because the space is so hard to come by. But why is there no real... there is ABC. But ABC is the classic example of reinventing the wheel every generation. Yeah, ABC New Rio. You know, I've had friends that have, you know, been on the committee, that have been on the collective. But when you get older in the punk scene, the word collective often just becomes code for, you know, group of kids that have no idea what they're doing, that get into really petty fights, that are bickering over whether this casserole is vegan or not. You know, you get a little jaded to that sort of thing. Yeah. And friends of mine who had been on the collective who aren't anymore definitely got jaded by that sort of thing in terms of wanting to put on really decent shows and having to fight with the younger kids who wanted to allow alcohol in the place, not realizing the logistics of, like, the trouble they get into, you know, all that stupid shit that they shouldn't have had to deal with. But every generation of punk kids, the generations are getting shorter and shorter and shorter, I think, because access to interesting music is so much easier. You know, it used to be like a rite of passage to find that 7-inch and have somebody tell you about it and know the record store you can get it. And now if you have, like, last night I wanted to download one song by The Jam, I think, that had been in my head. And I only have BitTorrent. So I had to download their box set. So, like, if you're a kid and you're like, oh, I'm interested in, I don't know, Fairport Convention. Yeah. Not that that's really what the kids are listening to these days. You could download 10 of their records. You know, it's no longer like, oh, wow, I found Legion Leaf on vinyl. You know, that doesn't really exist. So aside from ABC No Rio in New York, there isn't something like Flywheel. And there isn't something like... Yeah, like a physical place where shows are held and there are older people helping younger people. Because at Flywheel, there definitely are people there that are older that are holding it down. I've met some of them. They're great people. And also, there's nothing like Fort Reno in D.C., which is one of the best places I've ever seen Fugazi. I've seen them, saw them a few times there, which is an outdoor concert series in the summer. It's twice a week. It was started originally, I think, by a church to do choral music and then sort of developed into local music. So the reason that they can get away with it is because it was run for a long time by a minister, I think, or a priest. I'm not so familiar, you know, with being of the tribe with the way that churches work. But, you know, the sound company donates its time. The bands play for free. There's never any admission. That they can do that twice a week from someone who does 4 or 5 concerts a summer, that blows my mind. It's all volunteers. It's booked by volunteer. And granted, they aren't under the pressure we are to have, like, big headliners because they're doing it twice a week. And it's been around 30 years or more. It's, you know, it's a great honor for DC bands to be part of the Fort Reno series. But I just remember going there and you know, people were really friendly and the crowd was totally cool and the sound was great. And the stage itself, I mean, the first year I went, it was really funny. We'd never been, and I was with a bunch of punkets from New Jersey, and we had this vision of that famous Fugazi show at the Washington Monument, you know, where you look out and it's a sea of people. And we got there so early, and it was like us and a guy from Texas. And the stage looked like it had been dredged in the bottom of the ocean. It was this wooden platform with holes in it. And we're like, that can't be it. We must not be in the right place. And then as the day progressed, like, people started coming, and we're like, oh my God, I can't believe this is where the show is. But that's it. That was so, you know, inspiring to me. It's like, you could put on a show really anywhere. You can put it on in a shed. You can put it on in a crappy platform in the middle of a field in a park in Washington, D.C. And you can put it on in the Sampa Theater in New York. There's really no difference. Yes, the expenses are higher. Everything costs more in New York. But it's definitely worth doing. Because there is no real unity in terms of any New York music scene, because it's so big. And every different genre of music has its own sort of foothold or its own home base venue. But at least at Fort Reno, it doesn't really book one kind of music. Flywheel doesn't really book one kind of music. We try not to book one kind of music. So we were trying to do something like that, to have a Flywheel or a Fort Reno in New York City, in a public venue. I mean, the venue exists for the people to use it. It doesn't exist for MasterCard to put on a series. You know, I've been to Castle Clinton, and I think American Express is a major underwriter. You know, that stinks. That any sort of, or Clear Channel, any public park you go to, because of, and in my family we have a game of how many degrees till you can blame Ronald Reagan, but it is the sort of Reaganization. Yeah, like, I mean, in the United States, we have a lot of privatization. We have Reagan to thank for it, you know, be it of the public works or public parks, saying, well, you know, the government doesn't have the money and we don't want to tax people for the money or we won't get elected again. So we're going to sell off Union Square to the 14th Street Business Association, which they have. And if you live near Union Square, you'll notice how little park there is in your park. It's a green market, which is great, and then it supports farmers, but there's also restaurant there, which if you've ever eaten there is disgusting. There's a little bit of park in the middle, which you're not allowed to walk on because they're always growing the grass. There's the beach end towards Whole Foods, and that's really it. There's one little playground for kids. Mm-hmm. And while we all like supporting local farmers, we really wish we had more park in our park. Mm-hmm. And we don't. And the same thing is true to some degree of, you know, like Bryant Park. And then what's really depressing is if you, and I've talked with private parks advocacy groups, if you go to parks on the Lower East Side, they're just shut off because there are pieces of jagged metal sticking out, or the playground equipment's not safe, and no one's going to fork over large amounts of cash to fix those parks around the Brooklyn Bridge and Manhattan Bridge and Chinatown. It's just not going to happen. What's the other park that is just so depressing when you go there and just like, oh, you got to be kidding me. Oh, one of the people that I met who does parks advocacy, we met because he spent a lot of time and money having to raise private funds to fix a hockey rink up by Gracie Mansion. So there was this beautiful hockey rink that homeless men were living in and using as a toilet. And he runs a league for little kids. I mean, my league is for people that are technically adults. So, you know, he had to get money from the NHL. My favorite thing is he got a lot of money from Tim Robbins, because Tim Robbins plays hockey at Chelsea Piers and is a huge hockey fan. Uh-huh. But he had to rally all this private funds just to get the rink usable again. And it's a public rink. You shouldn't have to do that. In the post-Reagan era, that is what we have to do. And what we're saying is, you know, we've been an official 501c3 for 2 or 3 years. We're finally getting responses from some organizations in terms of, you know, oh, yes, please apply to us. Mm-hmm.
Is this for the hockey league?
Oh, no, hockey is... like, don't even get me started. No, this is IRMP. Okay. Hockey is its own weird... The hockey makes no money, but it sort of feeds itself. Okay. Like, it's... We're also a not-for-profit, but we don't... you know, there's a registration fee. There's just no real profit to it. Don't ask. But now IRMP is... Or East River Music Project, we all call it IRMP, is actually, you know... might be getting money from private organizations that are, you know, grant givers, but we sort of feel like death before corporate underwriting. Mm-hmm. The only thing we have that resembles corporate underwriting is we've invited local businesses and our friends' businesses to join the Support a Potty program, where I think it's like $180, which is the cost of a porta potty, will get you a porta potty with your name on it and the message of your choice. Because we believe advertising belongs with the toilets. But we've had some great, like, our lawyer is a woman named Quinn Harity, who is known, I think, among artist circles as being the woman to go to if you need legal help, because she knows from artists and she hates charging them a lot of money. She'd rather have lots and lots of clients that she doesn't charge a lot than if her name is Quinn Harity. I think it's Harity. I don't know if she's changed her website yet. It was Harity Law, I think. She used to have her law partner used to be John S. Hall, who, for people of our generation, might remember him from King Missile. And then he's sort of, I think he makes more money or doesn't have time to practice law because he's still doing spoken word stuff and touring and stuff. So they amicably decided to not have a partnership anymore. And now she's just Harity Law or Harity and Associates or something like that. Okay. But she's the one who helped us file our paperwork to become a 501c3 and helps us with all our nonprofit businessy stuff. She purchased an ad, you know, she joined the Support a Potty program and it said, "We help you with legal shit" on the side of the toilet. Or my friend Angela Boatwright runs a company called Killer of Giants, which manages artists and photographers. She herself is a photographer. And she had one that said, you know, "We manage photographers and shit." It always comes back to shit. But this amuses us. This amuses them. We get a porta potty out of it because the park has no toilets anymore. Everybody wins. And we don't have to turn to, you know, Con Ed or the other concert series. I don't know if they do it anymore. I don't think they did it last summer. I don't know if that's a harbinger. They'll never do it again. But Three Farms, which was done by Arlene Grocery, had massive corporate underwriting. You know, the Village Voice and Sprint and Con Ed provided their power. And, you know, they booked it in an Arlene Grocery way. God bless them. Like, I like some of the artists that they book. They book artists that are a little bigger, I think, than we do. But they'd always get screwed by weather. Always, always, for 2 years. Like, 1 year, it rained every weekend. I think it was 2004. And we managed to get the 2 or 3 sunny weekends that year. And they just got totally fucked. Like, they had, you know, tents everywhere and people handing out coupons. Because that's what happens when you have corporate underwriting. You have some poor college kid trying to make money in your face, thrusting a pamphlet, you know, under your nose. Or somebody trying to sign you up for a credit card or whatever. So they had these people, like, shivering out in the rain in their ponchos with, like, 6 people in the audience watching Laura Cantrell. And I like Laura Cantrell, so I thought that was pretty sad. But I was like, you know, Sprint can do a lot of things, but they can't control the weather. Sorry, Laura Cantrell. But I don't know. They didn't do it last year. I think they were, like, trying to take one season off to dry out. They're perfectly nice people. They took that approach, which is much easier. The way we do things is so difficult, I can't even begin to tell you. But they're the only other people, I think, that have really pursued concerts in the park. People come to us as if we are the point people for the Parks Department, and we're not. We can't help you get a permit. We can't provide sound for you. We aren't a full service concert company. That's not what we do. We do work with curators sometimes, but working with parks is very hard, and working with parks without any corporate underwriting is nearly impossible. So in the future, there might be more shows there. You know, Clear Channel might discover it. It might have a show there every weekend, courtesy of American Express. For now, though, it's just us with our porta potties and children's theater.
You're listening to Giant Ear on Free 103.9. The final part of the interview will be played in just a little bit. First, we're going to play an excerpt from Everyday Radiation by Johnny Farrow. He interpreted Inside the Belly of the Beast by using his guitar to pick up sounds of electromagnetic fields in his home studio and office, including CD burner, lamps, printer, pencil sharpener, cell phone, and he felt that that would reveal the beast that is right before our eyes. And after that, we're going to be playing Ceiling One by Ben Owen, and then we'll be headed outside and then Into the Guggenheim for a piece by Mike Hollenbeck.
Thank you.
Okay, we're now going to be playing a piece entitled Foul and Fragrant by Joseph Moore. And it is a binaural recording of Macy's December 9th, 2005, and its perfume counters on the first floor, including walking outside the building. You can find more of his smell-related studies of sound at www.telewriting.com. It's TelewriTing.com. Following that will be our final part of the interview with Sarah Bennett, the founder of East River Music Project, and you can find out more about that online at www.ermp.org.
Sap of soul like her.
Tommy.
Sample done how fresh, very good.
Tommy for men, sir.
Thank you.
So you work really, really hard to get these shows going and bringing music to people for free. It's amazing. I wanted to go back to, you mentioned the community around the park. Besides bringing more notice to the park, you mentioned the noise issues, and I was just wondering if you could give an example or how you've dealt with noise complaints or anything like that with East River Music Project.
Well, we've never gotten a noise complaint. If we had a noise complaint, they wouldn't give us our next permit. So we are ultra cautious to not offend anyone with the noise that we make. And it's interesting because the community around there, directly around there, not so much in the Lower East Side moving further north, is so diverse that it's really hard to appeal to everyone and everyone. And everyone being, you know, the Puerto Ricans, the Dominicans, the Hasids, and the Parks Department, and on the Asian community. And I won't even begin to try and pretend like I know what that, you know, what parts of Asia are represented around East Broadway. Don't even ask. For instance, when we tried to book, we've always thought, let's book for the Jewish community. Because there are so many interesting Jewish hip-hop bands, right? I mean, not just Matis Yahu, but anything on J-Dub. All of our shows are on Saturdays. There's no way we're going to do this. You know, it's not going to happen. We've had an audience come and watch because there's no work in walking to an amphitheater. I mean, I went to a Jewish school. I can remember a little what constitutes working on the Sabbath. You know, everything from turning your lights on to opening your fridge. Actually, walking is okay because how else are you going to get to temple? Teleporting? No. So I remember one year we had some FNU DJs and that rabbi who has a call-in show on WFMU came with his brood, and that was great. But we can't have acts that actually, like, I'd love to have klezmer, I'd love to have stuff like that, but it's so hard to book on a Saturday. You know, it's exactly. And then one of the women who helps book is the infamous Shirley Braha, who does New York Noise. It's very, I mean, I can't believe how young she is, but she's so sweet. And you know, she and I joke a lot because she's from a pretty religious family about booking stuff. It's just nearly impossible. The Parks Department has its issues with hip-hop. It's convinced that and there are a lot of older people that live in those towers. They're convinced, A, it will drive those people crazy, and B, it will draw a crowd that will tag the entire amphitheater, which they have, you know, it's relatively new at this point. Not as new as it used to be in terms of the renovation, but... And they repaint it all the time, but they really don't want to have to deal with that. And we don't want to have to deal with it because the bill will go to us. Not that we think it'll actually happen. I think that if, you know, we really got a chance... Every year, the running joke is Dalek is not playing. Every year, Dalek is like, we approach them. One of the guys... IRMP is really... I mean, it was my idea, but it's really a committee. There's nothing I do by myself. And one of the guys in the booking committee knows those guys. Every year, they're like, we want to play. And every year... They can't. They are recording a new record. They are touring in Europe. They're, you know, I don't know. There are a million reasons why. They just can never do it. This year we're hoping Dalek's going to play. I really doubt that if Dalek plays, the amphitheater will get trashed. Or if, you know, we get Prefuse to Guillermo. I keep calling him Scott in my brain. But if we get Prefuse to play this year, if he's not in Barcelona, we'll really have problems. You know, I doubt it. And, I've just named some pretty tame, relatively tame hip-hop acts. I don't think we could afford anyone who's big in the New York hip-hop scene because we can't really afford anything. A lot of people that play do it, well, pretty much everyone that plays do it because they love the amphitheater because there is no other venue like it. They love the idea of what we do. When we try and book for the community, we always come up against those blocks. Like, you can't do it on a Saturday. You can't have a lot of hip hop, or we're just totally ignorant. You know, like, I don't know what's hot in Dominican music right now. I would love to put it on a bill. The closest thing we've come to booking anything local are some people from the Clemente Soto Velez Center. I always screw that up because Spanish really not my strong suit on Rivington, and it was some capoeira and some Puerto Rican music and dance. And that was our first season when we had no idea what we were doing. We had not promoted the show at all. We had booked it at the last minute, which used to be what we would do. Because my belief in life is if you don't know what you're doing, then you don't know if you're going to fail. So if you really know what you're doing, you probably wouldn't do it in the first place because it's too expensive or it's too dangerous or it's too much work. The best ideas are ones where you just have no clue. And then you don't know how impossible it is, you know?
Yeah.
Because then I never would have done this. Because I would have been like, this is the stupidest idea on earth. A, you're going to lose money. B, they're so impossible to book. You know, whatever. So we booked the show. We didn't think anyone was going to come. We had maybe like 20 people coming, that it looked like. And then somebody on stage, after they were doing some capoeira stuff, said something literally that involved a sentence with the words Puerto Rico in it. And like 50 dudes came over the hill. And the joke of the day that Puerto Rico is the new Beetlejuice. That if you say Puerto Rico three times, you will get people there. Because that's literally what happened. And there was some really interesting music that day that was, you know, actually Puerto Rican. Women were jumping up from the audience and dancing on stage, you know. But, like, finding those acts or having those acts nowhere to find us is very hard. And we're not opposed to them at all, but we just don't know where they are. And, you know, if you're listening and you know where we can find them, ERMP.org, send me an email. I have no idea where they are. And we're working. We only have 3 dates. We really only can book, like, 12 bands. We have 5 dates total, but 2 of them are going to curators this year because it makes our lives a little bit easier. Okay. And because we like working with other people in the community in order to put on music. And we don't know what they're going to book, and we can't really tell them what to book. So for the 12 bands that we have, if 1 or 2 of them could actually be of Latin Hispanic origin, that would make me very happy.
For that.
Yeah. Or someone who's klezmer who does not mind playing on a Saturday. We could get the audience out there. They just have to walk.
So the email address, the website actually that you can go to for the East River Music Project is www.ermp.org, and you want to contact Sarah Bennett, and I think it says info@ermp.org.
Yeah, go to me or someone else or 8 of us. It's like our general mailbox.
Thank you, Sarah. We're going to have to wrap it up, and please give them money at www.ermp.org, ERMP.org, and that's the East River Music Project. The band shell, the shows open up in May 20th. Please check it out. Please check out the website. And you're listening to Giant Ear on Free 103.9. Okay, that concludes our interview with Sarah Bennett of the East River Music Project. And walking home from the interview, I actually encountered a tuba player on Lafayette, and his name was Jesse Dolman, and he plays at Tonic as well. But this evening he was outside sharing his talent with the whole entire street and the architecture and the buildings, and it was just really lovely. And coming up, we're going to be playing works by Liz Phillips, and they're a series of restaurants in Queens, and it was edited by her class, mostly by her class, her Sound Interactive Media 2 class at Purchase College. Okay, here we go.
Que no me enfocan. Que no me enfocan. Que no me enfocan.
Thank you. Many years ago, there's a fellow called Danny Carl. He was a Dublin itinerant, a traveller, and was making tins from Canada. And he became kind of obsolete, his business.
Leroy, I just grabbed my shoes
and went up. He's drinking.
I told myself, but I didn't
bring
it. I just ran up.
Danny is an individual with his dignity and all the rest of it. Oh, and it's football was a camp with his hand-me-downs and Williers and his sandwiches of brown. But now that payment peasant is a full-roll bitter man. Oh, it all the trials and sorrows of his traveling people's land.
Thank you.
Okay, that last one was by Sean Meehan, called Neglect, and it was based on the emptied-out McCarran Park Pool in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, which last year they just started construction on to build an amphitheater. Interestingly enough, I haven't heard anything really positive about this. I hear great things about the East River Music Project in Manhattan, but this new amphitheater in Brooklyn, I haven't yet heard anything positive about by the local community. We shall see. So I also wanted to mention Liz Phillips' work. We're not all restaurants. One was actually the International Hindu Temple of North America in Flushing, Queens. So please check out the track listings, the playlist, at our website at www.nyacousticecology.org. And coming up next, we're going to be playing a track I kind of swiped, actually, from Sound Transit. You should check it out. You can kind of take little journeys, little acoustic journeys throughout the world. So what I'm going to be playing is Leandros Tunis' piece, and it's a Saturday afternoon at the 24th floor of a New York skyscraper on 59th Street between Madison and Park Avenue. Here we go. So, wrapping up the show, we're going to be playing a piece at the New York Public Library by Mike Hellenbeck. And also, I'm going to be playing a track from a CD put together by Ben Owen. It is a disc in support of the New York Society for Acoustic Ecology, and it's performers from Tune Outside, an event last year from Free 103.9 at the Wave Farm in Accra, New York. And it's 8 sound works, and we're playing one by Michelle Nagai and Mike Hellenbeck, and it's entitled Divinity Nougat. And that will take us out of the show. Please send in your sound recordings to Andrea at 154 West 9th Street, number 1, Brooklyn, New York, 11231. And next show, February show, is entitled Kingdoms, Sands, Humans. So please send in your sounds of birds and bugs and pretty much all the kingdoms, as long as it does not include any humans in it. So thanks for tuning in on Giant Ear, Free 103.9.
Thank you.